Testing, testing.
Mr. Mayor, Reverend Clergy, representatives of the school system and the state and the county and the municipal government, ladies and gentlemen, I'm also grateful for some of the things you didn't say. For example, so often on an occasion like this, I find myself being introduced with a long list of, say, the pictures that I've made in the past. Now, I don't mean by this that I'm ashamed of them, but everyone who's been around Hollywood for any length of time has been in some motion pictures that the studio didn't want them good at one of them Thursday. And I've had my share of those. But years ago, we could always dismiss them lightly and say, well, as time goes on, you'll forget those bad ones. Now you just stay up at late enough at night in front of the TV set and they all come back to haunt us. Sometimes it's like looking at a son you never knew you had. But you know, you're a frightening audience. I stand here with memories, of course, fresh in my mind of my own days of facing those of your profession, and the reason you're frightening is because what an opportunity you have for revenge, and it would be well taken because I've caused your kind many problems in days gone by. Anytime a speaker faces a special type of gathering of this kind, he tries to establish a common meeting ground, some reason why he should be selected to be here. Well, of course, I would think that the very subject of a meeting of this kind is youth, and naturally, I have that in common. But because there are some narrow-minded people who might suggest that isn't so, I've had to look farther for a mutual interest. And even here, I could find one, the fact that about 1%, a minority that small of our young people, are tagged as delinquents, and as a result, all too often, all young people are smeared with the guilt and the problems of this small group. And I come from a profession, of course, in which we're not unaware of what most of our fellow citizens think of us. I think we eat our young. It was only a generation ago that the people of my profession couldn't be buried in the churchyard. The world has improved since then. We can be buried now. As a matter of fact, the eagerness of some of you to perform that service gets a little frightening at times. But seriously, perhaps we do have something in common. Perhaps the thing we have is that youth and the people, the community I represent, have been targets. We were a little earlier, back in our make-believe, tinsel and colored light town. A funny thing happened to us some years ago on our way to the studio. We ran into ugly reality. We found that on direct orders of the Kremlin, the Communist Party had ordered the infiltration and the taking over of our industry so that they could subvert our screens to the dissemination of communist propaganda. And now today we look at our young people, and anyone who has been familiar with the latest findings and studies in the party line knows that target number one today is American youth. They've reorganized their board of directors. They have a youth board that is entrusted with the task of aiming programs to subvert our youth. There's a page from a textbook that's been translated, a Russian textbook used in their sort of geopolitical institute in which they plan their steps ahead. And this page translated says, if we could effectively kill the national pride and patriotism of just one generation, we will have won that country. Therefore, there must be continued propaganda abroad to undermine the loyalty of the citizen in general and the teenagers in particular. At the same time that this evil enemy would deny us our God and our pride and patriotism, he imbues his own youth and those of ours he can reach with a fervor for the false god of Marx and his Messiah Lenin. Some time ago, I had a chance to read a page of a letter that a young American socialist had written to a friend. One passage of this letter said, speaking of socialism, it is my life, my business, my hobby, my religion. I have already been in jail because of my ideas, and if necessary, I am ready to go before a firing squad. We have a cause to fight for, a definite purpose in life. We have a morale, an esprit de corps such as no capitalist army ever had, a devotion to our cause that no religious order can touch. Well, if the words of that letter are true, and if there isn't devotion to our cause, then we have betrayed our sons and daughters and been false to our God and trailed in the dust, the golden hope of mankind. Soon these young people, who concern us so much today, will come into their legacy. They'll take their place as citizens in the freest and most unique society that was ever created by man. This legacy has been handed down by each generation to the next. Indeed, it's the only way we can inherit freedom. The late Judge Leonard Hand said, "Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no court, no law can save it." Well, perhaps the time has come for us, all of us as executors of the will, to check up on their inheritance, to see if these young people will know the freedoms that were intended for all of us by the Founding Fathers. Probably part of our trouble is that we talk of freedom in kind of abstract and nebulous terms. It sounds a little anymore like 4th of July oratory. Maybe we have to deal more in specifics. I think of this when I see a survey that was taken, a survey in depth of more than 5,000 young people of the ages between junior and high school and junior in college. When I say survey in depth and 5,000, I'm sure you realize that television shows go off the air or stay on the air on the basis of only 1,800 questionnaires throughout the entire United States. So these 5,000 young people represented something extra special, extra large. In a survey, they found that more than half of them believed that the government should have the ownership of banks and steel and transportation. More than 60% of them believed that the government should provide the jobs and that workers should not produce all that they could. They rejected the profit motive as being necessary to our society. And 84% of them denied that patriotism played any part in their lives. These young people can ask us today when we talk of freedom, well, who's free? At home, there are my parents, and at school, that's where you are. And if now and then they do manage to get a hold of the family car and get out on the highway, there's a fellow on a motorcycle that gives them a little trouble. But what do we mean by freedom in the practical sense when we talk to them? Some time ago, I had some business dealings with a book publisher publishing children's books. He was a German immigrant by the name of Wagner. Seemed like a fairly young man. But he told me why he was so devoted in the children's books that he is publishing to this cause of freedom. He said, "Let me picture for you when I went to school in Germany. And this wasn't Hitler's Germany. This was under the Weimar Republic. This was in a form of government that we believed was following ours, that they were free with a parliament, like our Congress, that the people had a voice in government." But he said, one day in our class, a teacher was trying to explain freedom. And this was the example he used. He said, "Suppose you were standing on the shoreline of America, the United States." And he said, 3,000 miles ahead of you stretches that country. And he said, "You're free to go any place in that 3,000 miles you want to go. Stop where you want to stop. Live where you want to live. And you don't have to ask anyone's permission." And he said, "Mr. Reagan, what do you think that meant to we, small German boys sitting there who lived in a community supposedly free, but we couldn't move from one apartment to another without going to the city hall and getting a police permit to make the move?" Freedom is deciding whether you want to go to college, and then if you want to go, deciding which college you want to go to. Selecting a career, perhaps the wrong one, doing a nosedive and having to start over again. It's taking a trip on a weekend when you want it without having to get permission to leave town, to say nothing of whether you had the means of leaving town or the coupons for gasoline if you had a car. In Hungary today, under the Soviet, young people who get married must make a choice under the law. They must either live with his parents or her parents. Then they put their names down for living space, and the average is several years before they are finally assigned to a place to live, and that's where they live, unless they have some extra political pull. In Russia, they recently announced the living space goal. The housing program was aiming at a goal of 80 square feet, a mere 8x10 floor space for each human being. By curious coincidence, 8x10 is the minimum requirement for a prison cell in our country. When we talk of the Constitution, we're not talking of an outmoded document that's dusty with tradition and time and that we want it just because of a nostalgia for the past. We talk of the Constitution because it's a living contract. It guarantees us the most limited and equitable government ever known to man, perhaps better than anything I've said to illustrate the difference and the reason or the cause of freedom. Is to take the two constitutions of the Soviet and our own. The Soviet Constitution says that the people of the Soviet Union have the right to freedom of speech, right to assemble, right of meetings. Now, of course, they haven't put that into effect, but it's there in the Constitution. And we have the same provision in our own. And you might say, well, then wherein lies the great difference between our two systems? Well, the difference is so subtle that it almost escapes us, but it is so great that it tells the entire story. The Soviet Constitution says, we, the government, grant you this right. And our Constitution says, you're born with this right, and no government created by man can take this right away from you. This is the most valuable part of the estate that they will inherit. This idea, never before tried in the world, that you and I have certain unalienable rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, that government is beholden to us, that it has no other source of power and can do only those things we, the sovereign people, permit it to do. And that brings me to the point of the evil in the current high-sounding phrase seems to be so much in vogue today, the greatest good for the greatest number. I think we'd all better do some analyzing and some thinking about that phrase before we repeat it, because what it amounts to is mob rule. If we subscribe to that, we're saying 50% of the people plus one can do whatever they want to do to the rest of the people simply because they outnumber them. One's right to life and liberty, the freedom of worship, to speak, to assemble, in short, our unalienable God-given rights may not be submitted to a vote. The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to forever put them beyond the reach of majority rule. But back to the inventory. A president of this country, some 40-odd years ago, before most of you were born, said a revolution is taking place which will leave the people dependent on government. Finding markets will develop into fixing prices and finding employment. And the next step will be to furnish employment, or in default, pay a bounty or dole. Those who look with apprehension on these tendencies do not lack humanity, but are influenced by the belief that the result of such measures will be to deprive the people of character and liberty. Who would deny that that man 40 years ago had something of the gift of prophecy? Even while most of us would deny that the socialist folly of Karl Marx would ever be acceptable here, we see our own government laying an increasingly heavy hand in every facet of our lives. It's a strange thing. In this complex society of ours, it only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 people to keep us well and healthy. It only takes 40 oil station attendants and mechanics to keep the cars for every 10,000 people running on the highways. But it takes 130 federal employees to minister the affairs of the national government for each 10,000 of our citizens. Since the beginning of the century, our gross national product has increased to where today it is 33 times greater than it was at the turn of the century, but the cost of our government has gone up 234 times. The government today owns more than a third of the real estate, and in the last decade, has increased that holding because 10 years ago, they owned only around a fourth. Robert Weaver, the Federal Housing Administrator, has publicly stated that in the beginning, the government gave the use of the land, the control of the land to the people in order to speed its development. But he says now, the purpose of the federal government is to regain complete control of the use of the land. I didn't remember history that way. It seemed to me that the people were here first and were on the land and they created a government. Our government is taking more than a third of the people's earnings, and still we're not paying the bills. We're letting those young people in on that. We haven't balanced the budget in 29 of the last 35 years. The interest on our debt is more than $22,000 a minute of every hour, 24 hours a day, day in and day out. Government is spending $260 million a day. We urge our young people to be ambitious, and then we subject them to a progressive tax that penalizes success and bids fair to destroy the American dream that wealth is denied to no one by reason of class or station. The late Sumner Slichter of Harvard said the tax history of the United States in recent years has been fairly sensational. He says a visitor from Mars would suspect that a communist fifth columnist was writing the laws for the purpose of making private enterprise unworkable. Now, I know it isn't considered politically wise or expedient to criticize the graduated or progressive tax. That's because we've been sold a bill of goods for a long time that this is a soak-the-rich tax. Well, it is nothing of the kind. The rich can invest their money in tax-free bonds and pay no tax at all. This is a tax that discriminates against the earner, against the professional person, against the salaried employee and the small businessman. It makes it literally impossible for them to accumulate wealth. The idea is sort of we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. You and I'd better look around, because we'll discover that all of us are named Paul. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul. Peter went bankrupt a long time ago. I've often thought, you know, on this Robin Hood theory, that maybe the reason Robin Hood robbed the rich was because they were the only people that had anything worth stealing. But there's a moral question involved. A Scottish economist many years ago, John Ramsay McCulloch, gave quite a lesson in economics. He said, the moment you abandon the cardinal principle of exacting from all individuals the same proportion of their wealth or their income, you are at sea without rudder or compass, and there's no amount of injustice or folly you may not commit. Our Judeo-Christian religious tradition economically is based on the idea of tithing. Both the Old and the New Testament tell us that we owe the Lord a tenth, that we shall give him a tenth of all that we earn. And he says, if I prosper you 10 times as much, you'll give me 10 times as much. He doesn't say it'll go up to 53 times as much. Well, I'm sort of inclined to inquire, if it's good enough for the Lord, isn't it good enough for Caesar? But we're concerned to move on, properly so, with a small percentage of our young people who, for whatever reason, and I charge not through any fault of their own, have failed to fit themselves for adult life. We've launched a program for retraining and these young people, and this is as it should be. No one would quarrel with this objective. They should be salvaged, and we should make every effort possible to do so. But haven't we lost our sense of balance someplace along the line? When we take these young men who have failed and we put them in a retraining program, and then we pay them at a higher rate than we pay the young men who put on the uniform of their country and go out and defend us on foreign shores. Young women. Young women are taken from destitute homes, and they're to be given a year's training in programs that will fit them so that they can leave their life of poverty and move on to something better. And so we ensconce them in luxury hotels for this job training and provide maid service so that they won't have to make their own beds. In Los Angeles, the Young Women's Training Program prorates out to a cost of $7,000 a year for each young lady we're going to salvage. You know that there are many families in this country doing a pretty good job of raising and educating fruitful citizens on less than $7,000 a year. Is it no longer believed necessary to teach the qualities of self-reliance, pride, and to pay back what we borrow? There's a small college town here in California. The Rotary Club of that town has a loan fund. This is their project. They raise money and they lend it to needy college students, no interest. The students pay it back after they graduate from college. The other day, the dean called them and told them that unless they were willing to make the fund an outright gift, the college wouldn't need it anymore because the federal government's putting up the money and the students don't have to pay it back. Now, all of us in this room were brought together on this occasion because of an interest we share in common. We are participants in the greatest public school system in all the world. That public school system in this country is a strange paradox. This nation was founded on the idea of individual freedom. Yet we depart from this basic principle to establish a compulsory system of education. But the founding fathers knew, and we know today, that we can only be free if we make such a compromise in our basic principle, only free of tyrants if we're a literate people, and if we are capable of controlling our own destinies. So we've made this strange dichotomy work by keeping control as nearly as possible at the local level. Now, you teachers have an understandable claim to academic freedom, and I'm sure many times that you want to stand up and demand the right to teach as you wish and as you see fit. But at the same time, we recognize there is an academic freedom that goes the other way. You're confronted by the rights of parents who are forced by law to send their children to school, and so they rightfully demand a voice themselves in how and what their children will be taught. Well, maybe the answer we've found down through the years isn't perfect. Compromise never is. But somehow the system works just so long as we keep it on a local plane where little Willie's teacher and little Willie's parents can meet sometimes nose to nose and argue things out. Now there is a threat, however, to this cumbersome but time-tested system. In an atmosphere of almost hysterical crisis, we're told that the economic problems of our educational system are so insurmountable they can only be met by massive doses of federal aid. Well, in the first place, if this is true, one has to ask, has the federal government found some other source of revenue other than our pockets? If the problems do exist financially, and I'm sure they do in most school districts, they exist mainly because the federal government has dipped into those pockets and usurped the tax revenues that once were earmarked for the local communities and the states. The truth is, we've been meeting our responsibilities at the local and state level pretty well. This last year, we passed the biggest total of bond issues for schools in the United States ever in our history. In the last decade, we've spent $30 billion in this country on classroom construction. We've increased school revenue at the local level by 156%. We've reduced the ratio of pupils to teacher and the ratio of pupils to classroom. And we've increased the national average of teachers' salaries over this last decade. Now, let me hasten to say, I don't think you're paid enough. Everybody knows teachers are underpaid, particularly parents on Saturday afternoon. But can we have massive federal aid without having massive federal control? Not too long ago, some distinguished educators, college presidents among them, went to Washington. They were fearful of the threat to academic freedom that is inherent in some of the many great college federal aid programs we already have. And they had worked out a program whereby tax monies could be earmarked for the local communities, whereby there could be a program of helping education without creating a vast new bureau or a new government agency. No strings attached, but the funds made available. And they argued over and over again, down through several days, as to why this system wouldn't work better than what is proposed. And finally, a sort of Freudian slip occurred. Francis Keppel, the federal administrator of education, blurted out to them, "Gentlemen, you don't understand. Under the system you propose, we couldn't achieve our social objectives." This is a little frightening, I think, social objectives. If education is the bulwark of freedom, can it not become the tool of tyranny if you remove it too far from the people's control and influence? One senator who's shown an unusual interest in recent years in new and exotic ideas has made a statement publicly that spiritually and economically, young people are being conditioned to respond to a liberal program of orderly policing of our own society by government. Is there something of an ominous sound in that term, conditioned to respond? In 1968, 17 million young people who weren't eligible to vote in 64 will be going to the polls for their first time, moving into their inheritance and their legacy. Now, these young people are, for the most part, at this point, under the influence of parents and teachers, and this is as it should be. But all our efforts are directed toward the day when they'll try their own wings. During the few years that we have them, they'll make a choice. Either they will reaffirm their belief in their right and ability to determine their own destiny, or they'll abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite sitting in a distant capital can run their lives better than they can run them themselves. Will they decide during these few years we have influence on them that a belly full of bacon and beans, shelter and cradle to grave security, marching toward eternity in a super ant heap as soulless freaks of nature in a godless world is preferable to the freedom of choice with its attendant risk of error? Or will they demand the right to fly as high and as far as their own strength will take them without being penalized for their initiative and their ability? Remember, those who would trade freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state can paint a very pretty picture because they deal in promises. They don't have any facts to confuse them. The brilliant Fabian socialist, the great playwright George Bernard Shaw, I'm sure must have had tongue in cheek, but at the same time was kidding on the level when he explained socialism and he said it means the equality of income or nothing. Under socialism, you would not be allowed to be poor. You would be forcibly fed, clothed, lodged, taught, and employed, whether you liked it or not. And if it were discovered that you had not character or industry enough to be worth all this trouble, you might possibly be executed in a kindly manner. But while you were permitted to live, you'd have to live well. Well, now what can we do to help these young people with their choice? Well, first of all, we can recognize and show them that government does have certain legitimate functions. We can also point out that beyond these legitimate functions is where we run the risk of government engaging in things it cannot do as well or as economically as the private sector. We can point out that we're proud in this organized society of ours, of those who set our course for the stars, who guard our shores, who patrol our streets, and yes, who teach our children. But that government is a referee in our daily competition with each other to see that we don't impose on our neighbors' rights and freedom. It's not a partner or a regulator in the free economy. The late Herbert Hoover said, "The greatest strides of human progress have come from the uncommon men and women. When we're sick, we want an uncommon doctor. When we go to war, we yearn for an uncommon general or admiral. We choose a president of a university and we want an uncommon educator. The imperative need of this nation at all times is the leadership of the uncommon men and women. We need men who cannot be intimidated, who are not concerned with applause meters, who will not sell tomorrow for cheers today." History tells us that every time a cultured society has met the less cultured, that the barbarians have triumphed. Belloc says, "In times of peace, we look at the barbarian, we're amused by his antics, and we laugh. But while we laugh, we're watched by large and awful faces from beyond, and on those faces there is no smile." Today, the barbarians are at our gates. They're combat lean, they're hard and hungry, and they think that you and I have grown soft. Well, have we? Or have we just become confused, a little unsure of what it is we defend? All of us pray, and have prayed, I'm sure, day in and day out, that the day will never come, or would never come, when our young men would have to bleed once again their lives and their hopes for the future into the sands of a foreign beachhead. But tragically, we learn the lessons repeated so often in history that, unlike a family quarrel, it only takes one to make a war. unless you accept the alternative, which is surrender. Now, there are those among us today who would suggest this. They give it another name, of course. They call it accommodation. They suggest that there is a large gray area between ourselves and this enemy, where we're both a little right and a little wrong. There's room for compromise. Well, compromise is a noble word. When people of goodwill are prepared to meet and each give a little, take a little, in order to come to a common purpose or a common goal. But as I say, compromise suggests a give and take. What is it we want from the enemy if we're prepared to compromise? Well, the plain truth is, peace could come tomorrow if the enemy would simply give up his avowed intent to impose his way on the world, his intention to destroy our way. Now, in order to get that guarantee from him, what are we prepared to give up? What will we do without to buy this peace? Our right to freedom of choice, our right to work and live where we want to, our right to worship God. The truth is, there is no compatibility between the dialectic materialism of the enemy that believes only in the physical side of man and our Judeo-Christian belief in the importance of the spirit. The fact we have to face is there can be no compromise between good and evil. We lighted a torch 200 years ago that said to the peasant in his mud hut all over the world that somewhere in the world, here in this land, men had banded together, men like himself, and they had established a nation where all were gathered together in a pledge that the rights of each individual were sacred. Will our generation end that dream and in so doing betray our children, or will we meet the challenge and be remembered to the latest generation? Thomas Wolfe said, "To every man is chance. To every man, regardless of his birth, is shining golden opportunity. To every man, the right to live, to work, to be himself, and to become whatever his manhood and his vision can combine to make him." This is the promise of America. You and I will keep this promise intact for the generation we now deal with and their children to come, or we'll fail in the challenge, and if we fail, our failure will be recorded in a book not yet written, but that will be entitled The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. Thank you.